For years, I picked my career over my kids. And I think of all the times I missed out. Now he's only five, so I'm fortunate enough that, he's still young. But like when I made the decision and gave up all the running and gunning, I went to day shift and I come home every day to my wife and kids, and I wouldn't trade that for anything now.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and today I have with me a gentleman who is here to share a story. And I think that everybody in the country is familiar with the incident that we're about to talk about, and it's the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida. But I appreciate you taking the time, Rick, and we kind of talked about a little bit about what brought you to the podcast here today. It happened to be one of our employees who did the podcast with us, who subsequently retired after an officer-involved shooting due to mental health issues. You guys connected and you got on the podcast, and you're going to hear to share some of your story. So maybe we start off by you explaining about, or a little bit about who you are and how long you had on the job, where you grew up, things like that.
First off, I want to say thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on this podcast. So my name is Richard Fink. I'm from Orlando, Florida. I grew up with the all-American family. My dad was a police officer for 25 years. He retired with the rank of deputy chief. I mean, he was the SWAT team commander. He was, a cop's cop. So ever since I was born, or that I can remember, that's always what I wanted to do. But unfortunately, my dad became addicted to opiates when I was in high school. It kind of destroyed our family a little bit. And after high school, I had no plans, wasn't really going to college. So I figured, hey, I'll join the military. So I joined the United States Army. I spent 5 years in the Army. And then when I got out, the agency that my father worked for is the agency that I, in my heart of hearts, I wanted to work for. So I came back here to Florida. And I've been working with this agency now for the past 9 years.
How did your dad get addicted to opiates? How does he go from a deputy chief to getting addicted to opiates?
Yeah, it's a crazy world. That thing can hit anybody. So he actually got the department the new SWAT truck and the new armor personnel carrier. So they did a little demo to show the city commissioners and whatnot. And he thought he was still a young buck. So he led the demo, and he was the first one off. As he came off the back of the truck, his bootlace got caught on a little lip on the door. He fell and hurt his vertebrae in his neck, and then it slowly just started spiraling from there. It was back in the 2003, 2004 time when the pill mill epidemic was going on. So, I mean, he would just go online and buy the prescription drugs, and it was that easy.
How bad did it get at a certain point?
It got to the point where it destroyed our entire family. And then in 2018, unfortunately, he died of an opiate overdose. So I think, that's the worst it can get.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, dude. That's horrible.
Well, I appreciate that. But that's part of the reason why I like to talk about it, because it's that stigma. His nickname was Zeus on the SWAT team. Like, Zeus. He couldn't come off the mountain and take a knee and say he needed help. He was too afraid of the stigma, and ultimately it led to, his death. So, but it was about 13, 14 year nightmare. I mean, we went from every Sunday sitting in the front pew at church. My mom was one of the head ER nurses at our big hospital here in Orlando. So the all-American family, we went from that to, 13 years later, 14 years later, he passed away from it. So
it's funny that you just triggered a thought that I had. My father subsequently got pretty injured. He fell off a scissor lift. He was an electrician for the Port Authority, and he was on like a flat scissor lift, and he fell off, busted his back pretty bad. I had to have multiple surgeries, rods put in his back, all this other stuff. But obviously they were giving him pain management medication. And I'll never forget my dad going into our linen closet. And again, I was already a cop. I happened to be there at that time. I wasn't living with them. I just happened to go upstairs. And I saw him go into the linen closet where the medication was kept in the hallway of the house. And he took literally a basket full of medication. And he said, I got to throw this shit out. And I said, why? Oh. He goes, I'm getting addicted to it. He's like, I can't fucking stop thinking about it. And I saw my father. I thought to myself, on a weird note, I'm like, man, this guy just wrote like $3,000 worth of street level pill. Like this is, he could be like $3K if he would have just known. Right. I mean, I'm goofing off, but my father at that moment, I never forget witnessing him just making that decision that he was not going to take the pain medication anymore. And it was oxycodone that he was on.
Yeah. And, I mean,
well, it was Oxycontin at the time. Right. So it was oxycodone. Right. So it was oxycodone. And
I wish my dad would have made that decision, but it was to the point where he, you know, he obviously left the agency. So his retirement, the monthly check he was getting in his retirement, he was using to pay for it. I mean, it was so simple. He, you know, my dad always preached to be a man in life, you have to have your word and your balls. If you lose either, you're no longer a man. So my dad preached integrity and everything. So he was 6'6", 285, which obviously played a factor in the dosage he got. So the next thing you know, FedEx shows up at our house every week, right? My dad says, oh, it's workout supplements. So we signed for the package, put them in his office. That's it. And then every 5 days they're here, every 4 days. And then just became every other day, FedEx was delivering these workout supplements. And my mom was a nurse at the time. So my dad would, we called them episodes, where my dad would either be like really almost like intoxicated drunk, like saying, he would either be like a really high, like that annoying drunk high, or he'd be like, you know, super like passed out, right? So when he passed out, we all thought it was his blood sugar. We'd run to the fridge. We had these little tubes of glucose. We'd open it, squirt it in his mouth. And then it wasn't until my mom was cleaning out the master bedroom closet, she moved a piece of luggage, and why he kept the empty bottles, I don't know. And that's when she finally discovered that these workout supplements are actually, you know, opiates. So
how did your mother react once she found that? Would it ultimately led to a divorce?
Oh yeah. So, but it was, you know, the pot calling the kettle black. Like I said, my dad, you know, he was there was a SWAT call out when I was in the third grade. So like maybe 6 years, 7 years before that. So my dad got some notoriety for that call out. He was on the front page of the paper because he held the two little boys that were being held hostage on the standoff. So image, you know, it's all about the stigma. My mom kept getting into wrecks, right? She would crash the car. And my dad always thought, oh, she's just a bad driver. Well, come to find out all those years later, my mom was actually, you know, stealing pills from the hospital. I mean, there was times where my mom would, you know, she used to go to the local roller skating rink. My dad, I'd go pick her up because she was crawling along the floorboards, you know? So it was a shock.
Why was she at a roller skating rink? Like what, how'd she end up there?
Oh, that was her pastime. She would go there like every Friday. That was her thing. You know, roller skating, I guess, was big back in the day. So she continued that into her adult life. And when she found it, you know, it was, oh my God, woe is me, this and that. And then, you know, years later we found out, damn, my mom was stealing pills from the hospital. But ultimately, yeah, it led to my parents getting divorced. It led to a huge rift between me and my family. And, you know, to this day, my mom and I don't even have a relationship. You know, it's a decision I made when I came out about my own demons a year and a half ago through my therapist and through the help of my support system. I realized she's no good in my life. Like she's never let it go from back then. You know, I sided with my dad, if you will, right? Of course, I idolized the guy. He's my hero. So my mom would kick me out of the house and I would have no place to go. I'd be too embarrassed to tell my friends. So I used to sleep at the shed that was in the baseball field at the local high school. So from 16 to 18, when my mom would kick me out, I'd go sleep in the shed. Wow. So all these years later, I try to move on from it, you know, like giving her the benefit of the doubt. But at the end of the day, you realize, you know, she does not deserve a seat at the table. So I took her out of my life and everything. And then when I met Mike, we were just talking about family and this and that. So I tried one more time to reach out to my mom and for my kids, right? I told my mom, look, you and I are going to stay status quo. But if you want to be in my son Camden and my daughter Reagan's life, this is your opportunity. You think you would jump at the chance? Like my daughter's going to be 2 in June and my mom's seen her one time. It's the second day she was born, or the second day after she was born. So my mom took a day and a half and then she finally sent me a text like, I think it's best if I stay out of your life. I love you all. Like, you know, just the victim. So it's like all these, she played the victim all those years. They both were screw ups. They both were addicts. I mean, it was just, I went, like I said, the all-American family to sleeping in a shed out of high school.
I'm going to give you a book recommendation that I brought up on yesterday's podcast. And I think we're probably going to get used to me giving this book constantly. You might have read it already. I don't know if you have.
I'm not a big reader, but I'll read this one.
Well, you can listen to it. So you can buy it on Audible or whatever you want. It's called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, How to Heal from Distant, Rejecting, or Self-Involved Parents, Lindsay Gibson. And I gave it to somebody recently as I tend to coach people in my life. Life's weird. And people who end up in my life who don't really have context of what I do for a living, when I see some potential in them, I end up. So this person, I gave this person this book as like my fourth recommendation for a book. Like, you should really check this out. You do have a kid.
Right. Da, da, da.
And it's so funny because once that person got involved in this book, they did not stop reading that book because of their fucked up childhood. So a lot of people find it very awkward when my mother's brought up, and I have the same sentiment. I have zero relationship. I have no interest. My therapist, I since then have stopped therapy. And if I need it, I will go back. But my therapist is like, do you want to work on that? And I'm like, no. Like,
yes, no.
I just have no interest in it. I've of a lifetime of, and she's like, well, we can get to a better place. And I'm like, that's cool. I just don't want to do it. It's not something that I need to have in my life. And I'm done. I've expended enough energy, and I'm just not doing it anymore. And it's the same thing.
Well, the title of the book, I mean, that says it all about, my parents, they were nothing but children, before, my mom and I stopped having a relationship, my brothers and I were literally like her parents. She'd call us if she needed money or help or this or that. It's just, so it's interesting what you said there is when you said, you're done. I went 15 months without speaking to my mom, nothing at all. And then, when I met Mike, I opened the door back in February for her. Right. So 15 months without talking to her, seeing to her, you think she'd want, to see her grandkids. But all she cared about was it was not fair to her that our relationship was going to stay the same. And I said,
well, your mother's a narcissist.
Yeah. Just like you, I said, I'm done, and I listened. I spent an hour and a half on the phone with her. I listened to the 100 excuses she gave me. And my wife asked me afterwards, why were you on the phone so long? And I said, look, one day my mom is going to go meet her maker, right? And when she dies, I can feel confident to say, I've done everything I could, right? There's nothing else. I listened to all her excuses. I've done everything, but I'm just done. And it's not so much for me. It's, I don't want to let my kids down, right? Grandma comes into their life intermittently here, there, right?
Right.
Now, and that's, so yeah, some people disagree, like, oh, she's your mother, da, 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 da.
Well, yeah, okay. So yeah. They disagree because they don't have context. And honestly, correct, it's a superpower to be able to take somebody who is typically somebody you should care for and say, yeah, this is done. I actually have been doing that a lot. And the cool thing is when you get rid of this crap, people who actually deserve a place in your life start to show up. And it doesn't have to be your mom. I'm significantly closer to most people in my life who are non-family.
So am I.
Just them.
Yeah,
and that's okay. They become your family. And I don't have a lot of people, dude. I mean, people say, obviously I know a lot of people and people like the work that we're doing. But I have a handful of people that I have very, very strong feelings for as other human beings.
Right.
I don't have a strong support system in the sense. Somebody said to me recently, you don't have anybody that can come over and help with the kids. I said, no, I don't have anybody. I got to pay somebody.
Right.
Everybody's alive, but I don't have anybody.
Yeah. For me, it's, you look at my wife's family and, it's this huge support system. Right. And then you look at Rick's side of the family and it's like, this is a sliver. It's my dad's younger brother and his wife. So my aunt and uncle are really, I would say, the closest people to me on that side of the family. But, my mom's a screw up. So I'm fortunate enough that my kids have my mother-in-law, and she is by far grandma of the year. What she does for those kids is the way my grandmother was to me growing up. And so, I'm fortunate for that. So I just realized, like, my kids focus on the good one and the bad one, you know, like you said it, narcissist. She could even, it was all about her, not the grandchildren, not seeing her right. grandchildren, talking to the grandchildren. No, it was about her.
But people find it wild when they have a fantastic relationship with their parents or siblings, to be quite honest, because I don't have either or. And they have a real hard time trying to understand how somebody could not. And I actually have a real hard time trying to understand what it must be like. I'm like, man, I wonder what that's like. And I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
My brother-in-law, who's my best friend, and he's more of my brother than my brother-in-law. I'm closer to him than his own sister. That is somebody that I feel, and I've just come from a very, very interesting background, and I'm not afraid to speak about it, and I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad. I'm just people hear me say that and they get offended, right? They're like, "How could you talk that way about your mother?" Right? Like, well,
even after my dad died, I was too afraid to tell people I was mad at him. Right? The anger that I had towards my dad, even after he died, I was still trying to like be the good boy and keep my mouth quiet because, you know, I didn't want people to think I was mad at him. But at the end of the day, you know, he robbed his grandkids of their grandfather, you know? So on the same token, my father-in-law, I have two father-in-laws. They're both phenomenal grandpas, how they should be, right? You know, they teach my kids this and that. And so I'm fortunate enough in that aspect. So it's like, when you look at the Fink family tree on the Fink side, but then you go to my wife's side and it's huge. So we just focus on obviously the good side. So, but you know, with my mom, I would take my anger out at my mom, the anger I had towards my mom, I would take it out on my wife when I was in my real deep depression and stuff. So I noticed, man, once when I, you know, gave her the boot, you get a little bit more, less stressed.
Oh my God, dude, it's the best.
You know, when she calls you, it's not to see the grandkids. It's, hey, can I have some money? You know, it's like, okay. But
yeah, no. I get it, dude. I get it, right? You're not the only one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I'm at fault. Maybe I'm at fault for not wanting to resolve a lot of that. But I'll do it when I need to, or if I ever feel like I do need to. But right now, no, I'm no such thing. I'm good.
Yeah.
And, you know, my therapist is like, but you know, be careful about saying that too quickly when you meet people. And I'm like, well, I can't hide it. It brings me instant anger. I'm the most calm, relaxed person I've met in your life, and instant fury when that woman's name is brought up. Instant, I'm instantly, and I don't like it because that's not how I want to feel. I mean, instant anger, and my whole life, it's a trigger for me. My whole life, I literally just instant fury.
And I think I look at, you know, my dad's failures. And, you know, my 6 years of the hell that I went through before I came out and started talking about my PTSD and whatnot, I realized in those 6 years that I was spiraling how much I was seeing my father in me in terms of, you know, the anger I had, and my kids would see that, you know, my son's five. So, you know, at a young age, I don't want him to remember his dad, you know, being an asshole or whatnot. Or when when your 5 year old tells you, "Daddy, you're angry," man, you know, that is if that's not an eye opener, I don't know what is. So
Rick,
you know,
you're gonna love the book. You're gonna love the book, because even if you're
I love the title. I mean,
you'll probably once you buy the audiobook and throw that on, you'll probably never stop listening to it. It's gonna hit, dude. I'm gonna tell you right now, it's gonna strike a lot of chords, man. So get ready, strap in. But in the interim, one of the side effects of it is it'll also put you in check of what kind of parent you are. And I don't know if there's anything we can do more in this world than be a great parent for our children. I don't know if I don't know if you should have a more top objective as a father than to be a great father.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I was fortunate enough, my dad and my grandfather spoiled me growing up. So, you know, I find myself spoiling my son, but then you kind of see like, it goes from wanting to expecting, like when we go to Target, he, you know, expects that he gets the toys. So it's like, you kind of retract a little bit, and then he gets, you know, he's sad. So you trying to find that, you know, median in between both. And for years, I picked my career over my kids. And I think of all the times I missed out. Now he's only five, so I'm fortunate enough that, you know, he's still young. But like when I made the decision and gave up all the the running and gunning. I went to day shift, and I come home every day to my wife and kids, and I wouldn't trade that for anything now.
If when it comes to us wanting to give our kids everything we never had, one, there's, I think all of us have some deep psychological. So when you can, I mean, I'm 41 going on 42, right? So I don't really, I like who I am as a father. I really do. I do my best, be the best father that I can. But what I do now is I do more of a reward system to get them what they want. Mm-hmm. So if they want something, I'm like, okay, well, you got to do something to get that. It's available. So for my kids, right, like every three sessions at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a reward. And that's how we do the positive reinforcement. So I want my kids, I have two of them in BJJ. The other one's 9 going on 10. He's like, I want an iPhone. I want a phone. I want a phone. I'm like, yeah, 25 sessions of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Or he'll see his brothers like, you know, how come they got stuff? And I'm like, well, because they get their asses up and go to BJJ. Because right, BJJ's work, dude. Like, they like it when they're there, but it's work. That's what's, it's not, if it's fun once you're there, but it's work to get up, to put your gi on, to get in the car, go for the ride. You go in, they like to run around, they do a warm up. But dude, it's work. You know, you went to a police academy. I went to three of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's,
like, I don't know if you've seen the same thing nowadays, but you know, in sports, let's say, like I wanted my son to play basketball or football. That's the sports I like, right? But he wanted to play soccer. So, you know, he's only 5 out there on the soccer field. And, you know, my dad, when he used to coach us in basketball, he was a hard coach, but it instilled in us the wanting to win and all that, right? So, but you see some of these guys out here today, it's like we give trophies to last place.
Well, your father probably, I mean, I don't think that, I think there's a fine line between inspiring achievement and pushing the boundary. We talked about this yesterday in the podcast. There's a poem, I'm waiting to get it, or an excerpt called The Long Ride Home. You might want to read that as well. And it has to do with these parents who are not understanding the perspective of a child and how they're treating them with these sporting events and what it does to you psychologically. So, well, you might, dude, I, you know, I said yesterday, and I'm not, I hope this doesn't come back to bite me in the ass. At a Little League game last night, I watched some parents get into their kids' asses because like their swing wasn't correct. And I just watched my kids having a good time and playing baseball. I don't ever intervene. Yeah, I literally said to my oldest, I go, Frank, when you swing, try to step. Like, so when you swing, try to step. And he started practicing it. That was it, right? And did he do that when he went out there? No, but he understands the concept of what I was trying to do. I'm not like, hey, bro, I'm watching you from over here. The reason you didn't hit that ball is you're not following your fucking technique, bro. And I watched the dad doing this shit, and you're fucking your kids up.
Yeah, I think, you know, you make a good point there. My dad was, he was like your first example where he knew what were the boundaries were, right? But you know, you watch some of these dads out here on the, now I'm not a soccer player, but at the same time I start picking things up, so I'm trying to coach my son during the timeouts or the half times or breaks. But you see some of these other fathers, they just sitting there on their phones or, you know, so disengaged from the sporting event. You know, my son, when he kicks the ball, he always like looks over at me and my wife, so it's just, he's looking for that positive reinforcement that he's doing well. So yeah, it's just I think.
Can I just jump in here real quick and just, sure. I do want to say one thing, because I think that we're very quick to cast judgment on the father who's on his phone, right? So like, let me give you another perspective of it. I'm a father who's on his phone as well. So I have an option. I can beat my kid's game and work at the same time and catch a little bit of it, or I can stay here and continue to work and not see any of it. So when a father on his phone, don't assume that they're scrolling Instagram. And I am on Instagram, it's because I'm creating content because I have to work. So I'm the dad at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I bring them 3 days a week, dude. I carve the time out. But they go 3 days a week. They go Monday, Tuesday, Saturday. But I'm also the father who's on his laptop while he's there. Because my only option is, if I'm going to get them there and I'm going to do that, I have to work while I'm there because of the job that I have. Now, dude, I'm going to tell you, I just had an unlock today. I made a decision this morning that I'm going to build a home office. I don't have one yet. I have a perfect room for it. So tomorrow, Saturday's project is setting up my home office, because we're going into the summer months and I'm having a hard time getting here on the weekends, especially. So I want to be with my kids, dude. I have 4 of them. I love them. Right. I love every minute with them. I enjoy them. Oh, tremendously. Now, do they fulfill every part of my life? No. But they fulfill a very big part of my life. It's not a void thing. I just don't want to miss. And that's what keeps me away from coming to this office on the weekends like I once had discipline when I had one or two. Now they're older. They want me there. They'll ask me. So
they grow up quick.
Well, dude, that's correct. I have four, right? So they do grow up quick. But, you know, I have to try to figure out a happy Mendoza line of how do I still float what street cop training is and what it means for everybody else to being a great father. And I'm not willing to put 16 hours in a day at this office. So I've got to commingle the two. So I think there's a good lesson to be learned there where you might come over and say, like, oh, this guy's up in the fucking room. Well, his kids are playing outside. Yeah, but I'm going to come down every hour and spend an hour with them. And then got to go back to work. Or I can right. see them, the room that I've chosen. I can look out to second floor room. I can see the pool and the hot tub. So I'll be able to have the window open and listen to them enjoying it. And guess what, dude? When their fucking seven friends come over, because I'm the funnest house in the neighborhood, they don't want me really involved for that hour or two. Right, yeah. They do want me involved for lunch. And so, dude, you know,
analogy was, I guess it was the wrong. What I meant is, like, you can tell those fathers that just are not, they don't really, you know.
I would actually argue that, dude, I would actually argue that they're better than the ones that don't even show up. Right.
Oh,
so they're
1,000%. 1,000%.
And again, I'm not saying it has any reflection on me, but I'm saying they're there. Right. I think that we should be concerned of where the other father is and then having compassion of why he's not there. This is a way to see life that's important to see life. So the practice of non-judgment is something that if you start to employ in your life, oh, it's fantastic, dude, because you just stop talking shit about people. I mean, you just stop making preconceived notions. I'm still working on myself in some sense, but I also play this game of like, it's not my business. You know what I mean? Like,
Yes, for the ones that aren't there, I feel like shit, even if I miss my son's practice. You know, like I'd cry everything I can to get to my son's practice and his games and whatnot. And just watching him run around on the field, it's like, you know, it's amazing to see, like, oh, that's my son out there running and having fun, you know, and he kicks the ball and he thinks, you know, he's Pele, it's a soccer player. And it's such a joy to see. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. It's better than the ones that aren't there. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, dude, it's very admirable that you, you know, care so much for your kids, and maybe some of that great fatherhood that you possess now comes from the fact that you're trying to avoid putting your kids through your experience in the past. And just one more comment on the father thing. Like, you know, my kids will ask me, hey, can you coach? Can you be my coach? And the answer is, I'm sorry, I can't. And it's not that I don't want to, it's just that I have obligations and there's nothing I can do to change those obligations. I cannot obligate or commit to being on that baseball field three times a week when I know that I had, did I travel? I missed bring your kids to work day last week because we had the conference. It was Thursday last week during the conference. And I've been catching shit from these kids like, hey, you, like, what the fuck? And I'm like, yeah, guys, listen, I get it. I'm trying to help you see it a little bit, right? But the week before, your father took all of you to Florida and stayed at a beautiful resort. We went everywhere you wanted to go. Most families can't do that. In Orlando, because our next conference is at the Gaylord Palms. So right at, obviously in Orlando. Yeah, yeah. So we went there and I'm like, guys, you know, I get it. Your friends got to go to work with their fathers and that meant a lot as well. But you've got to try to understand that this is our life and it's unique. And this is what daddy does for a living. And I have obligations. And dude, I got to tell you, people might say, well, that's
pays the bills.
It's not even that's what pays the bills, brother. I'm going to go even one beyond that. Like, how dare I take this power that I have to go out with this gift and train other police officers who are parents to learn how to not die or keep themselves out of significant legal trouble. And I don't share that with the world because of my own self-interests. So yes, there's a real responsibility to possessing power in the sense of what a shame it would be if you didn't share this with the people who needed it the most. And when I hear from somebody who says, I'm going to be at Christmas this year because you saved my life, my kids would not have had a father. It's not about the Beninos that much anymore. But I also bear in mind that I am a father and sometimes it is about the Beninos. And there's a balance, dude. There's people will say things and judge and Boy, as soon as I hear judgment, I get rid of people in my life real quick. But, you know, even my mother, she's like, you guys don't eat dinner together? And I'm like, well, we do breakfast together here. She's like, oh, I just, and, you know, just the passive aggressive comments. And I'm like, well, we eat breakfast together here. So every morning I cook my kids like a continental breakfast.
Yeah,
and that's where we spend a lot of our time.
Grading you on how you're being
a parent. Fuck these people. Like, fuck anybody who's judging you on how you're doing things, right? So I said, you know, Ma, we're not really in a, like, this is not, and I'm not to anybody's detriment, and I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad, but I'm like, we're not exactly sitting in a Cape Cod here in the fucking middle of fucking where we're from. You know what I mean? Like, we got to this place because our life is different. You know what I'm saying? So that means some of that different stuff that you think is traditional is I'm not here for dinner because I have to work because I'm trying to give my kids a better life. And what we have to do. And this is how it fits into my life. So listen, dude, I say this all the time and I tell people this. This is my life. It's not yours. I have no judgment on how you want to live. You want to live the way you want to live. As long as you're happy, God bless. I hope you live in a fucking tent on the side of a hill and you wake up every morning and fucking harvest a squirrel. And I don't give a fuck how you want. It's not how I'm trying to live my life. It's how I want to live my life.
Yeah.
That's not my potential. And I don't want
to. Definitely not my potential.
Well, my point is like, this is my fucking life. So don't worry about how I live my life. Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Street Cop Podcast, do us a favor and give us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you're listening to us. Tell a friend. We don't charge anything for the episodes. We appreciate your support. Check us out on any social platform by putting into the search bar Street Cop Training. Give us a follow. We have a lot of free content coming out every single day that you might not catch here on the podcast. And it's important for you to be able to do your job more professionally. And we also entertain you as well.
Right.
So again, this is not about Dennis is doing this great stuff. Like I could understand where the panic comes from. I could understand it. It's like losing your girlfriend to a fucking dude, right? Like
instead of the company, instead of the company focusing on themselves to get better, they try to, you know, tear you down. And like you said, it only makes your stock rise even more.
Just don't criticize me for living my life the way that I live it. And I will not criticize you, but I love this. I love doing this. This is my passion. It sounds but it's true.
No, I mean, I completely agree. Like I mean, just in terms of being a police officer, right? Like running and gunning, that was my thing. I loved it. But what I realize now, what I love more is helping other officers or speaking with other officers. It's not like, you know, good for you. Go out there and get all the arrests and all the guns and stuff. But, you know, that's not me. I enjoy like talking to you or talking to other officers. That's what I enjoy now. That's my passion. So
brother, I mean, you just explained my life, right? I mean, I was nobody running gun harder than me. And, you know, I realized that I'm probably at this point, I think in my head, like God gave me the 14 years in a job. Right. And I think he said, that's enough. You got what you need. Go and fix this shit. Right. Go. You're the guy's got the right emotional intelligence. For the most part, you've got the right intelligence level. You've got the work ethic and you're a resilient motherfucker. Like you're the guy and maybe you're not, but at least you shouldn't waste the potential of you could be the guy. And the fucking crazy thing is I might be the guy. And I don't mean the sense of like, it's just me. When you're kind of the guy, everybody who else is the guy and the girl, they kind of they all kind of come and float towards us. And they're like, hey, I'm kind of that guy too. And I'm like, great, let's all fucking team up and start to fix this shit. Because if we could look at each other.
That's literally how I found you. Yeah, I was on YouTube just looking up because I had to give a presentation about PTSD. So I didn't really know how to make a good speech or delivery about it. So I just started looking up PTSD, police officers, and then police leadership training, this and that. Next thing I know, I see your page pops up, right? Then, you know, I'm on TikTok and there's Street Cop again. It's like, you know, Big Brother and AI are always watching, right? So it just becomes more every social media platform. I see it. So I was just like, oh, you know, instead of watching the Netflix while I'm working off duty, I start watching your podcast. And that's really how I met Mike, is I was watching that podcast. And then ultimately that's what led me here talking to you today, is because I was watching your podcast and I met Mike, and here we are months later. So no, I completely agree. It's, you know, what you're doing is people want to win the race, right? But they don't want to be out in front, right? They want to hang back and this and that, but ultimately that can be too late at the end of the day, right? You have to have these guys that come up there and say, no, let's build this team. Let's work together, right? And I think that's what's so important. And when I started watching you, is it's kind of the same thing. Like when I started speaking about my own demons, you know, one officer calls me one day and I barely know him. And he said, "Hey, my wife just served me with divorce papers." And like, I know you, Dennis, better than I know this guy. But I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry to hear that." And he goes, "Yeah, I know it's awkward that I'm calling you right now, but I thought, I heard you talking about how you got help." And I thought, shit, Fink needs help? He doesn't even look like he needs help. Well, if he can get help, I can get help. And that's kind of how, what I think, what you are is like, it's a good representation of a law enforcement officer. You know, the haircut, like being uniform, looking professional in uniform, you think these guys have no, like, demons at all. You know, people say I laugh and joke, but they had no idea the hell I was going through. And then once, even the chief of police before our current chief, he's like, "Hey, Fink, how are you getting these officers to come forward?" And I said, "I think I made one post on social media about PTSD and stuff. And that is what just brought it forward. It's, well, shit, if he's doing it, okay, I can do it." You know, it's like these rough and tough guys on the exterior, but on the interior, they're like so afraid. And that's what I was for so many years, right? But I think now it's the rough and tough is actually what's on the inside. You know, I think it's so important. And literally, I came back and I'm telling one of my partners how I went to rehab. And then boom, that officer heard me. And that's why he called me at the end of the shift and was like, "Hey dude, I need help." You know, and it's amazing to see something just browsing YouTube. And that's how I found Street Cop. And then it just progressed from there. So, I mean, I think it's so important.
Let me tell you about my morning ritual, which everybody's sort of like, "Oh, here we go again." But one of the more parts of my morning ritual is after I cook my kids breakfast, I have a cup of coffee, and I'm gonna go a little healthy here and some thought. I try to get as much sunlight or artificial light into my eyes before I drink coffee. You're supposed to let your circadian rhythm wake up naturally before you introduce caffeine. So 60 to 90 minutes, I usually go 60 because that's my morning. But 60 to 90 minutes before you take your first cup of coffee, and I drink my coffee black. But every morning when I drink my cup of coffee, it's den time. I sit on the couch and I go on YouTube, and now it suggests anything. So I usually end up on, right now it's like Alex Hormozi stuff for business. Jordan Peterson's coming up a lot. And something that Jordan Peterson said this morning, it was I usually look for like 8 to 12 minute videos because I don't have that much time in the morning. I got a lot of stuff to do. And I was so good. And this is why it's so important to constantly feed your brain this fertilizer. Because it really translates well to a guy like me who's able to take this information and spread it to a group like us. Jordan Peterson said, "I'm afraid to say things." Because this guy says everything, right? "I'm afraid to say things,
yeah.
But I'm more afraid to not say things."
Right? I completely agree.
Yeah. Same thing, dude, right? Do you think that I'm not paying? I literally, to my detriment, have to stick up against all these things that plague law enforcement. And dude, I pay significant dues. I get my fucking teeth kicked in. You know, I mean, I just do, because I don't want to pander or ignore what the real things are. And when I say things like, "This is what a leader should look like, this is what a chief should look like," and a chief hears that who doesn't look like that and bans all his men and women from coming to my training.
Yep. You're blackballed.
Right? Temporarily. And I'm okay with that, because there's a lot of chiefs that agree with everything that I say. But I was at least able to get to the next chief who will unban me again in 3 years and then become that chief who everybody wants. So if I don't have these conversations, to my own detriment, nothing will change. I am not unafraid. I'm telling you that right now. I Monday spent about 2 hours and this never happens to me, in full blown anxiety, which never happens. Not where I was like in a panic attack on the floor, having like fucking deep. I was just like, couldn't think, had a lot going on. And I knew, because I'm emotionally intelligent, that this would pass. And I was actually laughing about it. I'm like, anxiety is kind of funny, because it's about these things that are going to happen that almost never happen, that we conjure up in our brain. I'm sitting here telling myself that, but I couldn't think. It was, you know, the Monday after the conference, and I was just getting unloaded on. Not only was a Monday at this company a lot, Mondays are always busy, but it was a Monday after the conference. We hadn't been here for 5 days. And, you know, I got to tell you, yesterday, Thursday, a lot of relief. Continual relief as I go on through the week. And I keep saying this thing in my head, Rick, and it's, you have saved a lot of lives. You have had a lot of police officers tell you they did not stick a gun in their mouth because of something you said. The work that you're doing, it's not about you. You are going to be the whipping boy. You are going to pay dues, but this is not about you anymore. This is about other human beings. And it's crazy is what they don't realize, you know, and in my head, I have to conjure up how insane all this shit is. There are people that you think are on your side, like politicians, that aren't, right? Well, there are chiefs of police who you think are here for the cause and that are not. And the crazy thing is people tend to follow those people, but they're completely arbitrary. They're completely against and running interference for the things that should be corrected. And you just got to stay the course and follow your beliefs. But I try to remember, this is why we are here. This is why I try to do what I'm doing. And I'd rather, you know, do the right thing and not say anything and not try to fix this thing. Because I'd hate to be 85, 95 saying, I had a real shot at doing something. I just ignored it. And I'll never get that shot again.
Yeah. And if you think about, you know, what you said, you know, you're afraid of what not to say. Think of how many officers, deputies, sheriffs that who knows where they would be, right? And if you didn't say something, one of my best friend from the police academy, he was shot and killed in the line of duty in 2017. And so all these years later, I started doing these presentations, speaking about PTSD and whatnot. The agency that he worked for invited me to come speak. I was terrified. And I was terrified because I thought those are his guys, right? It was just that thought was like doubting myself. Right. So it took his wife calling me and saying, I think you have no idea, like you're his guy too. Right. Like, so when I went there and did it, one of the officers reached out to me after class. Turns out he was the first one on scene the night of the shooting. And he tried to do life-saving efforts on Matt, but unfortunately Matt was shot in the head. So there's really not much he could do, but he needed some help. So I got him some resources and whatnot. And that was at the beginning of December. And then Christmas Eve, he sent me a text. Just want to say Merry Christmas. Because of you, my kids are going to have a Merry Christmas with their father this year. You know, so it's just something like that. Like I was so afraid to go speak. And then I did it. And look what happened. You know, this guy's telling me that I'm the reason why he had a Merry, or his kids had a Merry Christmas because their dad was there. So I think you make a good point. Yeah, you're afraid of what you don't say, because I think if you never had the courage to come forward like you did, take all that stuff away. You know, it's insane. And
well, I let's think go it's, back to the moment where I decided that I was going to start this training company, and like, you know, I'm. What if I just didn't do it, right? Like, yeah, what if I just was like, you know what, I'm just going to do what everybody else does, and I'm going to ignore this call that I think I could do more. And where would we be now? And people, you know, again, there are critics, but there are so many people, thousands upon thousands of people that are so appreciative of the efforts that we put forth and the lives that have been saved. How selfish it would have been of me to not do this, right?
Well, look, I am thankful you did that, because you doing that led to me watching your podcast, which led to me, you know, seeing Mike. And, you know, now I consider him one of my closest friends, and we've known that each other for maybe 4 months, right? And he's the one that where, you know, I doubt myself. He calls me and, hey, dude, think about what you're doing, all the other officers you've helped, right? And so I know Mike, I could call him right now and he'd answer. And I was like, if I need you down here, he'd fly out tomorrow, right? He's just that guy. So for someone like me that's, you know, starting to realize what's important and maybe not being a police officer anymore. You know, Mike went through it. You know, he left law enforcement. So having him, you know, behind me, pushing me all the way means so much to me, because when I start to doubt myself, you know, Mike's right there. So yeah, just think if you never did that, you know, where would I be? And Mike's one of probably my biggest reminder, if you will, of what's important, right? It's not running and gunning anymore. It's, you know, your wife and kids, leaving law enforcement, this and that. So yeah,
I'm, for you, I'm, yes. For you, that's appropriate because it's your life. And dude, I got to be honest with you, for some people, running and gunning is super important. And if that's what people are into and that's what they love, God bless.
For me, that's all it was.
Yeah. And dude, everybody is allowed to lead their own life. And I, you know, it takes years and years of experience and wisdom to say things like that. Everybody's allowed to live life the way they want to. And you don't have to live up to anybody else's standard. And I used to tell kids that I was field training when I was field training people as a, I guess you call a senior patrol officer. I would say, they would go, hey, why are all those cars in that 7-Eleven? You know, right. Why are there five marked patrol cars in the 7-Eleven? There's, when we're out here like doing all these traffic stops, I said, listen, you don't got to worry about why that. Just know those dudes in there, they're good dudes, all of them. And if we hit the fucking button, they're all going to come. I go, this just isn't it for them. They're not into this. And that's fine. And I tell those guys all the time, I don't care what you do, right? You shouldn't care what I do. When you hit that button, just know that your boy, you know that I'm coming. And I just want to know that you're coming.
Right, yeah.
Of course we're coming. I know that, right? Working, you guys, these are some of my best friends outside of work. Did I appreciate them as coworkers, as friends of coworkers, right? But they were not stomping down the highways. But dude, I can tell you, I don't know if the time that I needed somebody or something, they didn't show up. And I would just tell them, don't get into the thoughts of why aren't they hard chargers like we are. It's fine, right? But you know, you find your other hard chargers here. And if they want to live their life the way that you want to live your life, that's great. No judgment. You do your thing, I do my thing. And that's a great way to live, man.
You know, there's younger guys on my squad that, you know, they want to run and gun and hey, come on out there with us. I'm like, look, I'll be in the background, right? Like I'll help you. I'll teach you how to write the warrants and whatnot. But I lived it. I had fun with it. And now I know, like, you know, it's a good chapter in my life that I can close. I don't need to go out there and, you know, run and gun anymore. I loved it for, you know, the 8 years that I did it. But now it's, you know, I realized what I have a passion for now is, you know, helping other officers or speaking or just being there, being that guy like Mike is, like, I can call him or he can call me and, you know, I'd be on a plane tomorrow for him. So it's just, and shit, even my wife made the comment, it's like, you guys are dating. Like we just, I mean, you know, being police officers, we just clicked.
There's a song by Frank Sinatra called That's Life. And I don't know if it describes my life any better, but I think you should read the words and listen to that song after you read the words to hear it and what it actually means. Because if you haven't watched the Netflix documentary on Frank Sinatra, I got to tell you, it's probably the most fantastic stories that you'll ever see in your life. And I don't think it's about entertainment. I think it's about understanding what that man went through and what his life was about and who he ended up being at the end. And, you know, that documentary on Netflix is just fantastic. It's so good. And it's just so many lessons in it about what it meant to be that person and the end of his life and what it meant. But anyway, well, listen, dude, I'm going to say this. We are never going to be able to get to the thing that we're supposed to talk about today. So we're going to redo this again. So we'll call this part one of Rick and Den's podcast. And stand by. Part two will come out shortly thereafter this, because it's going to impede into the next podcast. It's getting recorded in about 30 minutes. And we're never going to start opening up the Pulse nightclub shooting and all the things that you went through in the amount of time that we're gonna have allotted to do that. So
I mean, I appreciate that you're giving me another opportunity to do this.
I appreciate that we went somewhere that you had no idea we were gonna fucking go, and we made magic today for all these people who needed to hear about that. And I gotta tell you, nothing about this podcast was bad. It was fantastic, dude.
Yeah, I told you before we started recording how anxious I was, and then you know, next thing you know, I'm about to go listen to an audiobook and watch Frank Sinatra. It's like, I didn't think it would go that way, but.
And the excerpt, The Long Ride Home. I haven't read it yet, but I'm told.
No,
you're going to love, that's your homework. So let's talk about that next time we get on together. We'll go into the shooting. We'll go into what you went through and what you're going through now and your mission. And I don't mean to cheat anybody out of that story. I'm sure you were looking forward to it. But once we start going somewhere on a podcast, I hate to turn around because it was well worth the ride off the fucking path.
No, I actually respect that. I respect that you didn't say, all right, let's get back to what we were supposed to talk about. You know, you kind of just, we drove down our own path, and I took several things from you. So I appreciate the fact that you're giving me, I'm excited to get another opportunity to be on your podcast. So I have no problems at all. So
here's the good thing. You took stuff, but I knew that if you took stuff, the thousands and thousands and thousands upon people that listen to this are also going to take stuff out of it as well. And that's kind of who we are at this company. That's another hat that we wear, is to try to say, hey, look, I'm a cop too. I'm the cop's cop. I'm the guy bleed blue. I'm that guy. I have a foul mouth, the whole nine. I've done it all. And this is what I've learned. And if it helps you, great. And if it doesn't, you knew this already, fantastic. But right. We don't want to ignore our responsibility here at Street Cop Training, or even myself personally, as being somebody that can help give guidance. And I think that people find the guidance we give valuable enough to listen. So why stray away from that?
Yeah. Even just talking to you for the hour we've been on makes me, when we hang up the Zoom call, it makes me want to go looking into more about how to, like, look at the nonprofit that I want to start even more. Because, you know, hearing your journey about the real estate and the working the 10 hours and stuff, right? And I'm thinking, shit, I watched Netflix this morning. I could have been, you know, researching more on how to build a nonprofit. So it's like, dang, man, you realize how far you're going.
That's a big unlock, brother. Yeah. When you're big unlock is actually accounting for what your day looked like. That's a big unlock.
I appreciate the opportunity. I look forward to talking with you again.
We're going to do it again, Rick. Great seeing you, dude. And we'll have just text Frank and let's get the second one scheduled.
You got it, sir. Thank you so much.
Rick, hang in there, brother.
Thanks, Ben.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.